Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
Family and friends, there's a topic that could be real vanilla. Totally inoffensive and non-provocative. I'll try to avoid that. Yeah, I looked up family and friend and friendship in reference works on philosophy and sociology and found it exciting in an arcane way. I looked up famous quotations because I was thinking back and not remembering a whole lot of really good stuff written about family or friendship that really came to mind for me as a kind of memorable thing. There's a lot out there. And I looked through books of poetry that I'd recently read. I found an awful lot about how miserable certain parents were. You know, and in a recent anthology of poetry I was looking at in preparation for Mother's Day, I found a whole lot of poems about fathers and almost nothing about mothers. And then kind of put that aside and haven't looked at it since. But I want to talk about family and friends today because I value friends and I value family. And I concluded as I prepared for this morning, I could best do this by telling some stories and see where they led us. But first, I want to make real clear what I mean by the words family and friend. Because after poring over sociological literature and philosophical literature and Merriam-Webster's dictionary online, I concluded there are a lot of explanations that don't tell us much of anything useful. Or that point in very curious directions that would take us up into the stratosphere of discussion and not clarify anything about how we live. So by family, I mean a group of people who live together and are related by blood, adoption, and or marriage, or some other implicit or explicit bond or commitment. That's still pretty broad. And a nuclear family typically lives in a single household. An extended family lives in multiple households, typically. Okay, you can tell I used to teach sociology. But when I get to some of the stories, you'll understand that this still fits. By friend, I mean someone one is attached to. A person who's attached to another person by affection and loyalty. The connection to friends, in my view, is deeper than the connection to mere acquaintances. Not that acquaintances aren't important, but there are different levels of connection in our lives. And there are other meanings for these words. Friends can also refer to a religious group, who we also call Quakers. Friends and sisters can refer to members of religious orders. Family can refer to religious orders and groups of people who follow a teacher or so on. But I want to stay close to the common sense, the families we live with and the friends we know. So let me tell you about Uncle Gus and Aunt Molly. Uncle Gus and Aunt Molly lived in the house next door to ours in Danbury, Connecticut. Gus, his brother Ted, and my father had bought this parcel of land in the late 30s or early 40s, I'm not sure which. I know the documents are packed away somewhere in my storage unit. And then they subdivided it into four lots. The three of them bought this parcel of land, which is about 7 acres, and divided it into four lots. Three of the lots faced the road. They didn't face the road when they bought it because there wasn't any road. They built the road themselves. And this is the 1940s, and they did it with picks and shovels and rakes and no heavy equipment. The fourth lot was behind the three house lots, held in common with absolutely no road frontage anywhere. So basically, they created three nice housing lots and one useless, valueless lot. My father was not a whiz at business. The three of them were immigrants, my father from Sweden and Ted and Gus, who were brothers from Norway. They all worked in factories in New York City. And after they bought the land and divided it, each built a small cottage on his lot near the road. And then, year after year, spent summer vacations and good weather weekends building houses room by room, bit by bit, until ours was big enough to live in, and we became the first to move out of the city, in our case the Bronx, into one of the houses on one of these lots. My father left his job in the factory in Manhattan. Well, actually, more it left him. They moved to Albany. And he wasn't willing to move to Albany. So he decided there was enough house. He and my mom and my brother and myself would move to the house he had been spending his summer vacations building for years. And he got a job in a factory in Danbury. Gus and Molly moved next from Brooklyn. When Gus got a job in the same factory where my father worked, Gus and Molly had no children. Ted and Doris never moved permanently out of Brooklyn, though they eventually built a fairly large house room by room. I don't think they ever actually lived in it full time. But their daughter, who was widowed at a young age, her husband worked in a warehouse, was killed in a loading dock accident, and grandchildren would spend summer vacations in the house. Now, their grandchildren were similar in age to myself and my brother, because my father was almost 40 when he first became a parent. So my brother Paul and I always knew our next-door neighbors as Uncle Gus and Aunt Molly. We didn't learn until we were fairly well along in childhood that they were not relatives by either birth or marriage. But they were Uncle Gus and Aunt Molly. Now, we had aunts and uncles that were blood relatives, lots of them. Two of my father's sisters, Ella and Tullen, had also emigrated from Sweden to the United States and each had one child. My mother, who was born in the Bronx, had one brother, Freddie. Well, one who survived to adulthood. And he and Aunt Margie had three children, and followed us from the Bronx to Danbury. They successfully made the move from a housing project in New York City to a housing project in Danbury, Connecticut. But they eventually owned a house and had two more children after moving to Connecticut. My mother's Uncle Mikey and Aunt Kitty stayed in the Bronx, where they raised three daughters in a basement apartment, which is part of Uncle Mikey's compensation as a building superintendent. But their children, my mother's cousins, were closer in age to Paul and me and our cousins than they were to my mother and her brother. And of course, then there were the aunts, uncles, and cousins in Sweden. My father was the oldest of 10 children, only three of whom came to the United States to live. Seven stayed behind. And even at the age of 68, I still have not met all of my aunts, uncles, and first cousins who live in Sweden, even though I've been there. There are a lot of them. I have just described an extended family. And we had holidays with these people. Aunt Molly and Uncle Gus were our next door's neighbors. We had holidays together. We had, I remember the trips to the Scandinavian delicatessen to get those, you know, Swedish fish balls that I could never stomach even before I became a vegetarian. And the lingonberries out of the barrel and the like. So through my childhood, this extended family, except for the ones in Sweden, lived relatively near each other, either in the Bronx, except for Tullin, who, as I said, had a husband who was a building superintendent, but the building he superintended was on West 57th Street across from Carnegie Hall. He got an apartment where you could see daylight from the windows, but not in the front facing the street. They lived either there or in or near Danbury. As my father sometimes begrudgingly said, they all followed us. But why were our next door neighbors Uncle Gus and Aunt Molly? Well, there's kind of a general explanation. For I've been told that there are several cultures where adults the age of one's parents are often addressed as aunt or uncle, even if they are not your parents' siblings. The custom can serve as a sign of respect for elders who are close to the family but not actually relatives, and thus closer than those who in the years when I was growing up would always be addressed as Mr. or Mrs. Palmgren, which happened to be our neighbor's last name. Now, the friendship between Gus and my father went back to the 1930s, and they were part of a wider network of Scandinavian immigrants. And my father had married across lines to a Norwegian for his first marriage. He was widowed young, which is how he was connected to all these Norwegians, even though he was Swedish. And Gus and my father were very loyal friends. Very loyal friends. And because Uncle Gus and Aunt Molly had no children, they delighted in the children next door, who were, truth be told, the children of Gus's best friend. Now, there was a hedge set up between the two front yards, but there was a space in it so people could walk back and forth easily between the yards. And we did it all the time. But we had to be careful of Uncle Gus's beloved flower and vegetable gardens. As long as we didn't trample them, we were always welcome. But he was an avid gardener. And Aunt Molly's Norwegian pancakes were loved by all and considered to be just what the sick child needed. In fact, Paul and I both had stomach afflictions where the only food we could keep down were Aunt Molly's pancakes. Interesting, huh? Now, so far as I know, other than Ted and his wife and children, Gus and Molly had no other family in the States. So when it came right down to it, we weren't just neighbors and friends, we were family. The narrow and older definition of family is as a unit of parents and children and can include close relatives living with them. But today we have a much wider, more expansive idea of family. It can include more distant relatives by birth, adoption, or marriage. And it can include individuals who are not related by birth, adoption, or marriage. And I could, if we really wanted to stay here a long time, describe to you some of the families I've met over the years where there are all kinds of explanations as to who was who, because the relationships really weren't obvious and sometimes weren't even after they were explained. People made their own families. Social scientists have a fancy word for people like my Uncle Gus and Aunt Molly: fictive kin. Made-up relatives. And my story, of course, is far from the only example, and I would be surprised if there were not others in here, this room this morning, who have or had fictive kin. People treated as relatives who weren't by blood, marriage, or adoption actually relatives. Now, many social scientists use this term to describe what they consider to be a relatively recent and growing phenomenon caused by increased mobility in American society. When nuclear families of parents and children live far from the grandparents or siblings or cousins, or when older couples move away from their children and grandchildren for less expensive retirement homes, they sometimes promote more distant relatives to closer roles because they have closer proximity, or because they're just angry at the people who would otherwise be in those roles. Or they choose non-relatives to play family roles. And as a minister, I hear of these more often at memorial services than anywhere else. And sometimes in planning the service, there, as I suggested before, a lot of explanation as to who is who, because it isn't always so obvious. Now today, if you read the obituaries as avidly as I do, it's a professional requirement. I've seen some descriptions of families that even have my head puzzling in print. It's only recently that people have listed among their survivors cats and dogs. And caretakers in assisted living, though they may have become very close and closer to any surviving family member at that point. And I know that was true of one former parishioner of mine who long outlived her husband and was very frail as she approached 90. Well, 20 years ago, Susan Ahern, a freelance writer, and Kent G. Bailey, a professor at Virginia Commonwealth University, wrote of this phenomenon in a book titled Family by Choice: Creating Family in a World of Strangers. In an interview at the time of publication, Ahern described how she and her husband, having settled in a city far from their families of birth, became close with an older couple who served as their two sons, as she put it, local grandparents. "They've been there for us," she says, "and in their home is a collection of photographs of the boys since they were infants." But this choosing family beyond the lines of blood kinship and adoption goes back to Ahern's own childhood, when she was a white girl with red hair growing up in a black neighborhood in Wilmington, Delaware. She describes her mother as functioning as a single mom of four daughters because of her father's disabling clinical depression. The young Susan found no stability and support at home. But she says she found what she needed from the African-American neighbors. A quote, "I was not accepted at my white Catholic school. We were poor and lived on the wrong side of the tracks, but I was accepted as one of the neighborhood kids where I lived." While in first grade, Susan was struck by a car. She lay in the street and her father and mother were unable to manage the situation. Their next-door neighbor, an African-American man named Harry Thompson, kept the scene under control until the ambulance arrived. Says Ahern of Thompson, "He was my surrogate father." Now, there are scholars who argue that the idea of family of choice developed out of the gay rights movement before marriage equality was even seen as a possibility, and that same-sex couples identified as families of choice. And by 1991, the term was viewed as an affirmation of gay rights and also the development of caring relationships for people with AIDS during the early years of the AIDS epidemic, where friends and neighbors stepped in where family of origin would not. Well, another example that connects friendship to chosen family. This one's a little humorous, though not without a bite. Jody and I know well, and over many years, from even before we were married, two women of color who are sisters. Some years ago, one of them suggested, since that we all have the same last name, Johnson. Well, Jody doesn't use Johnson, but we're married to each other, so she'll answer to it. That since we all have the last name Johnson, maybe we are cousins. Now, needless to say, we don't look at all alike. But as one of them said, maybe we're cousins, because you never know. What makes this somewhat complicated, as well as provocative, is that their having the name Johnson is a product of the history of slavery. And slaves being called by the names of their masters. While mine is the mangling of my father's Swedish name when he became a citizen. In a sense, the three of us have the same name because of the forces of WASP, shall we say, white supremacy culture, which fueled and was fueled by slavery and has historically anglicized other non-English names, even those from other Northern European countries. So I suggest that even before marriage equality, families could take many forms. And the shape of the family was not given once and for all by any revelation. But now with marriage equality, we recognize legally many more of the variations that have existed for many, many years, but often not acknowledged. Human beings are ever adapting family to the needs of the people they live with and love. Now about friends. I have 933 Facebook friends. And a very small number of these are friends. That is to say, individuals to whom I am attached by affection and loyalty. Facebook has done a good job of debasing the concept of friendship. I have many more relatives on Facebook than actual friends. They're all Facebook friends, you know. In fact, I have cousins I'd never know what was going on in their life if it weren't for Facebook, because they did move away to Montana. But even more of my Facebook friends are acquaintances and colleagues, people whom I know and respect, if only from a distance in some cases. But we're not friends. We don't have dinner together. We don't call each other up when something's going on in our lives. Well, here's a story about friends. When I was in Boston earlier this month, I had lunch with J and L. I'll just use their initials. They are not a couple. Since they were roommates 45 years ago, people have been trying to make them into a couple. They are not a couple. But they have been friends since they were in college and came to Boston together in 1970 to look for jobs from the South where they were from. Now, we've known each other since 1972. We got to know each other through the Mission Hill People's Revolutionary Food Cooperative, of which we were avid members. And since they lived in the Back Bay and I lived on Beacon Hill, we lived not far from each other. And nowhere near Mission Hill, which was in Roxbury, where the food co-op was based. And we see each other now maybe once a year, but we've managed to remain friends after I left Boston for California, then came east and this and that, because we formed deep bonds of friendship during the 5 or so years we shared as young working people in Boston, living in neighborhoods that were close to each other, and being avid about cooperative food buying. Well, we're also all quite fond of beer, though Elle concluded at some point she was drinking too much of it and has been sober for over 20 years. So sometimes when I'm in Boston, I will see one or the other or both. This time it was both, for light afternoon repast at the Globe in Copley Square, a restaurant that occupies the first floor of the Community Church of Boston building, which is not a church building but an office building, and they meet on the third floor. Elle had not wanted to visit a year ago, having just been diagnosed with a life-threatening illness, a mere year after retiring from a career in sales. This year, she was up for a visit, responding well to treatment, but still not totally healthy. The three of us talked about travel, the news, mutual friends and acquaintances, including my wife, Jody, whom they've gotten to know over the past 15 years. Of course, a discussion of Elle's health was in order, as well as Jay's more recent retirement from business and the great deal of contract work she still gets sent her way, even though she has tried to retire. And, of course, my inability to grasp the concept of retirement. And then it quieted a bit, and Elle looked at me and said, "I am so glad you make the effort to keep this friendship going. You value friendship, and so do I." I replied, "I value my friendship with you." So I can say I have many friends and a few lifetime friends, and Jay and Elle are among the lifetime friends. The lifetime friend I'd known the longest since we were 5 and 6 died 3 years ago. He was the youngest of 4 of us, all guys, who had been close from junior high school through high school and then to a lesser extent through the years since. 3 of us went to college. The friend who didn't go to college has remained in the town where we grew up, and the rest of us went elsewhere. But he lived very close to my family's house, and I'd see him, his mother, his wife, on some of my visits to see my mother before she sold the house and moved to assisted living. Now, the one I'm closest to is the one I describe as my best friend, as he also describes me. We've known each other for more than 55 years. Yeah, I remember when I thought 50 was old. He and I have known each other for more than 55 years. That's a shared lifetime that includes 2 marriages for him and 3 for me, 3 children for him, 1 for me, 1 grandchild for him, none yet for me, parallel careers in ministry. Each of us has had a sibling die, though he is a minister in a different denomination, but another liberal denomination. But what cemented this friendship was the William Henry Harrison Memorial Jug Band, which we organized when we were in high school. I mean, jug band music was a big deal in the 60s, and we played it. And we thought naming the band after William Henry Harrison was a fitting tribute to the U.S. president who died after 1 month in office. Though some historians think that had he lived, he would have proven to be the worst president ever. Well, Tim played banjo and mandolin. I played guitar and washboard. Kevin, our friend who died 3 years ago, played washtub bass, kazoo, and recorders, and sang better than any of us. And in fact, in later years, sang with the Boston Lyric Opera. Well, about 15 years ago, Tim's older brother and only sibling, Gary, died suddenly. A few years later, Tim said to me, "I need you to be my substitute brother." When Tim's middle son was married, Jody and I were seated with family at the reception, his brother's widow and her 3 surviving children. The oldest had been killed many years earlier in an automobile accident. The youngest, then a teenager, said to me, "I know you're important, but I don't know why." I mean, his mother had been having a great time talking with me, you know, because we've known each other since we were in high school. I told him that his uncle and I had been friends since we were about 12 years old, but that I did also know his father, as did my older brother. And he got it. You know, these are bright kids. But this did remind me of one poem by Nikki Giovanni. "We are not friends because of the laughs we spend, but the tears we save. And people being close friends with each other shed tears, but also save tears. and help each other get through the tough times. Is there a hard line between friends and family? Sometimes I doubt it. We can make friendships at any age, and we are learning to make and remake families at any age. There are people I take care to nurture friendships with whom I've met at various times in my life. Of course, it's easy when they're next-door neighbors or colleagues one sees frequently. But the neighborhood and collegial connections are only two of the places in my life where friendships can begin. One of the others is religious community. And there are others. The sad part is that as a minister, I cannot generally keep up friendships in congregations after I leave them. I can count on the fingers of one hand the friendships I have from previous congregations. Well, we may be down to one finger at this point. This is not because I don't like and enjoy the people. I really do. And there have been people in every congregation I've served who could have become lifelong friends. But the role of the minister, while one of love and respect and support, which are characteristics needed in families and friendships, has to be transferable and not permanent. Lest the relationship with the new minister be hampered by nostalgia for the past style of ministry or just likability factors, which are truly different from person to person. Now, ministers who settle in the congregation for a long time may very well develop friendships within the congregation, and that is appropriate. But they need to leave these behind when they move on. And there are a few exceptions, but very few. That's why I can count them on the fingers of one hand after 40 years. The writers who assert the need to reshape families by choice because of mobility are right. With careers demanding long distance moves, individuals and families need to develop new connections. And both adults and children need these, and where better to make friends and enlarge the family than in a community of shared values, such as the Unitarian Society. Deep friendships are formed here, and some of them have been formed and cherished over many years. As people grow older and families of birth, marriage, and adoption shrink, the congregation may well be the family an older person needs. I observe deep and durable friendships among members and networks of care that look a lot like family. And even if not everyone in a congregation can become a close friend, and how could they? It is a community where affection and loyalty are valued and nurtured. And when I address you as brothers and sisters, as I do once in a while, I'm really using a looser meaning of the words, meaning affiliation and membership, but it is no less valid because it also requires loyalty and affection to be part of a religious community such as this one, which can be the basis for deep, loyal, and loving connections. And most Sunday mornings, I look over at this front row here, and I think there's a family of choice that at least assembles on Sunday mornings there. And maybe in that row too, but it's pretty sparse today. And maybe in other rows. So in a few weeks, I will be moving on. And about the end of June. And in August, your new minister will arrive. And there will be new relationships to build. But the relationships you have with each other that you treasure will continue, no matter who is the minister. And the love and support of this congregation will be yours as ministers come and go. And that is one of the powerful things about a liberal religious community, with our shared values, our commitments to principles, and our caring for each other. We model friendship and we model family in a world where both need encouragement and nurture. And so may you do that in the years ahead as you begin your next ministry in a couple of months. And I know I'll be working on it wherever I travel. Blessed be. Amen.